Fort Worth, Texas, March 24th, 1873. Proper protocol demanded that any visitor report to the post commander. Nathan found Captain Ferguson in his office.
It's good to see you again, Stone. It's been downright peaceful in Indian Territory lately, at least in the western half.
I hope so. I don't aim to ride there again if I can avoid it. Two men tried to get the drop on me in Waco. One of them got away.
You've made enemies, and you're wounded from the look of it. Is it giving you much trouble?
I can't saddle and unsaddle my horse, can't load and unload my pack horse, and it's a hell of a job getting my boots on and off.
Why not have the post doctor take a look at your wound and lay over a week until it heals?
I'll take you up on that.
With time on his hands, Nathan hung around the post telegrapher. Having learned the code while with the Kansas Pacific, he read all incoming messages without difficulty. Clint Barkley was still loose in Texas. The James Gang was still robbing banks in Missouri, while Ben Thompson and his troublesome brother Billy were working in a saloon in Ellsworth, Kansas. Within a week, Nathan had grown weary of Fort Worth, and he rode out on the second day of April. Avoiding most of Indian Territory, he crossed the Panhandle, forded the Cimarron, and rode to Dodge City, Kansas. The rails had reached Dodge in the fall of 1872, and the town now seemed overrun with gamblers, whores, confidence men, buffalo hunters, hidemen, and camp followers. Where once there'd been a tent with cots, there now was a three-story hotel. Across the street from the hotel was a livery, and Nathan went there first, then crossed to the hotel, Cotton Blossom following. Taking a room on the first floor, he paused in the lobby. Thanks to the railroad, there were newspapers from Kansas City and St. Louis, as well as Dodge City's own weekly. Nathan bought copies of all three, continuing a reading habit he'd acquired while tracking the killers who had murdered his family in Virginia. In his room, he read the local paper first. It alternated between crowing about the town's progress and deploring the end-of-track and cattle town violence that had made it all possible. The paper reported that in the first 6 months of its existence, there'd been 9 murders in Dodge. Nathan found more accounts of the James Gang's thievery in the St. Louis Globe Democrat, but little else to interest him. But when he turned to page 2 of the Kansas City Liberty Tribune, what he saw brought him to his feet in a rage. Looking back at him was his own image. It was the etching prepared by the Kansas Pacific 2 years ago. But now, the etching was part of a reward notice offering $5,000 for Nathan Stone, dead or alive. It was offered by the Limbaugh family and went on to accuse Nathan of murder in the killing of Rusty Limbaugh the year before. Nathan ripped the paper to shreds and sat down on the bed, his hands trembling. Cotton Blossom watched him, knowing something was wrong.
Damn these people! I did everything a man can do to get around killing that little varmint, but he wouldn't have it any other way. Come morning, Cotton Blossom, we're headed to Missouri. I am to raise hell and kick a chunk under it.
Kansas City, Missouri, April 6th, 1873. Nathan arrived at the offices of the Kansas Pacific Railroad, determined to learn why the company had allowed the use of the etching in a reward notice that was virtually a death sentence. When Nathan shot and killed Rusty Limbaugh, he had acted in self-defense. And since the state hadn't pressed charges, the Limbaugh family's reward should have put them in violation of the law. Nathan had little doubt he would be vindicated, but that would be small consolation if some bounty hunter gunned him down before the wrong could be righted. He located the office of Miles Herndon, the railroad's attorney.
Mr. Stone, you must understand that the Kansas Pacific had nothing to do with the etching being used in a reward dodger. The Liberty Tribune created the etching to complement the story the Kansas Pacific supplied. The etching belongs to the newspaper.
You're telling me this damn newspaper can use a likeness of me any way it sees fit? Even in an unlawful wanted poster that could get me shot dead?
That is what it amounts to. And attacking the newspaper will get you exactly nowhere. If this reward has not been sanctioned by the state, then it's illegal and as such should and could be withdrawn. you would do well to contact the state's attorney general, requesting that he contact the sheriff in the county where the reward has been posted. If the law agrees you acted in self-defense, then a cease and desist order from the attorney general could be served through the county sheriff.
Well, that's sound advice, but I'm 180 miles from Jefferson City and Missouri's teeming with bounty hunters who'd kill me for a hell of a lot less than $5,000.
After buying another paper to replace the one he had ripped to shreds, he placed it in his saddlebag and began the long ride to Jefferson City. Jefferson City, Missouri, April 10th, 1873. Nathan aimed to get that cease and desist order before some would-be bounty hunter took a shot at him. In the outer office of the Attorney General, he encountered his first obstacle.
The Assistant Attorney General will see you shortly.
Ma'am, I'm not here to see an assistant to the Attorney General. I want to see the Attorney General himself.
I'm sorry, sir, but the Attorney General will see you only if circumstances warrant it. His assistant, Charles Atchison, will make that decision.
After an impatient half hour, Nathan was shown to Atchison's office. Atchison sat with his hands clasped, looking at Nathan over the top of his spectacles. Nathan leaned on the desk, the newspaper under his arm.
Mr. Atchison, I need the help of the Attorney General.
So does everybody entering this office. I suppose you're going to tell me why?
I am.
Without wasting words, he explained events leading up to the shooting in Springfield, renewing his claim of self-defense.
If there are no charges against you, then you are within your rights to demand that this offer of a reward be withdrawn. Such an offer is indeed illegal. A telegram to the county clerk in Springfield should determine that. You're welcome to wait in the outer office.
Uneasily, Nathan waited, considering the possibility that the Springfield sheriff had yielded to pressure and made him a fugitive. Could Atchison, excusing himself to send a telegram, be summoning the law to arrest him? But within half an hour, Atchison beckoned Nathan back into his office.
There are no charges against you in Springfield. Court records call the killing justifiable homicide. This office will issue an order to the sheriff in Springfield, and he will notify the parties involved that their offer of a reward is illegal and is to be withdrawn immediately.
Suppose they refuse to abide by that order?
Someone will have to take them to court. The state will prosecute, but only when formal charges have been filed.
So, if they ignore your order and refuse to remove the price on my head, it's up to me to file charges and take them to court? What will the court do, spank them?
Your sarcasm is not appreciated. If they are found guilty, there would be a severe fine. At least $50, I'm sure.
Send your court order. I'll go on keeping my guns handy and an eye on my back trail.
Nathan returned to the livery where he'd left the horses and Cotton Blossom. He had but one consolation, and that was that he'd seen the notice of the reward only in the Kansas City Liberty Tribune. But Kansas City was a jumping-off place for anyone heading west, and that damning reward notice might hound him wherever he rode. He was only a few miles from St. Louis, and he decided to go there. While he was still miles away, he could hear the bellow of steamboat whistles, and it brought memories of those pleasant days in New Orleans with the McQueens. Once in Kansas City, Nathan saw to the care of his horses. Then he chose a rooming house not far from the riverfront, with several cafes and saloons nearby. He had no trouble finding copies of the St. Louis Globe-Democrat and the Kansas City Liberty Tribune. These were a week later than the issues he had read in Kansas City, and he wanted to see if the reward notice appeared in either paper. First, he fanned through the Globe-Democrat and then the Liberty Tribune without finding the offending advertisement. However, in the Kansas City paper, he found a piece that grabbed his attention. One of the James gang had been captured and had sworn that neither the James nor younger gangs had shot and killed Bart Hankins during a failed bank robbery in Gallatin, Missouri. Now the Hankins family had hired the Pinkertons and had posted a $10,000 reward. Hankins had been the first of seven men Nathan had tracked down and slain, keeping the oath he had taken on his murdered father's grave.
Damn it. The glory seekers were bad enough. Now this.
At first, he could see no way the Pinkertons could tie him to the killing of Hankins, but his mind wouldn't leave it alone. By God, there was a way. The Pinkertons had enough influence to gain access to military records, and thus might learn the identities of the other men with whom Hankins had returned to Virginia. Six men who, along with Bart Hankins, had died by the guns of Nathan Stone. For the persistent Pinkertons, there was more than enough evidence to establish a pattern. While all Hankins' companions had been gunned down while trying to kill Nathan, there was nobody but Nathan Stone who could swear that Bart Hankins had drawn first. It was time for a decision. For the next 2 weeks, Nathan allowed his beard to grow, leaving his room only for meals and to see that the livery was properly caring for his horses. Finally, the mirror convincing him his appearance had been sufficiently altered, he made the rounds of various saloons, sitting in on poker games but avoiding high stakes. Feeling a little more secure, Nathan rode back to Kansas City. He had continued buying regular copies of the Kansas City Liberty Tribune without again finding a reward notice with the etching of himself. Perhaps the Attorney General's order had served its purpose, or perhaps the Limbaughs had just given up from lack of success. In the current Kansas City Liberty Tribune, Nathan discovered something that intrigued him. Edward Beard, a saloon owner from California, had established a saloon and dance hall in Delano, just outside Wichita. Beard advertised round-the-clock high-stakes poker and was seeking house dealers. While with the Kansas Pacific Railroad, Nathan had spent many months in various Kansas towns. It was time to learn whether or not his changed appearance had made any difference in towns where he was most likely to be recognized. He rode to Delano and offered his services to Beard as a house dealer. Delano, Kansas, May 26, 1873.
20% of the take. It's your game. I ain't responsible for slick dealing, card shaving, knife and gun work.
So that's why you're in Delano instead of Wichita. No law out here.
It's no business of yours why I'm here. If you can't ride the bronc, then stay out of the saddle.
I can ride your bronc. Just don't get in my way.
Beard had a whorehouse upstairs, and he was anything but gentle with the women. For some reason Nathan never understood, Beard's place was enormously popular with the military, and soldiers were there from as far away as Fort Dodge, Fort Leavenworth, and Fort Hayes. Nathan and two other dealers, Benton and Kinzer, worked the tables from 3 p.m. until 11 p.m. And Nathan got the impression that these men were more hired guns than house dealers. The night of June 3rd, Nathan had his suspicions confirmed. Two soldiers got into a violent argument with Emma Stanley, one of Beard's prostitutes.
Damn you! You owe me change!
I gave it to you! Besides, you got your money's worth.
You gave him something, but it wasn't change.
Give me what you owe me.
What I owe you is a good kick down these stairs.
One of the soldiers drew his pistol as a threat.
No! No! No guns!
It was an accident. She grabbed my gun arm.
Benton, the house dealer, drew his Colt and aimed to shoot the soldier in the back, but Nathan drew his Colt. That should have ended it, but Edward Beard cut loose with a Winchester. The soldiers who had argued with Emma escaped, but Beard, firing wildly, gunned down two innocent soldiers. Private Doley took a slug in the throat at the base of his tongue, while his companion, Private Boyle, had his right ankle shattered. Every other soldier in the saloon went to the aid of their wounded comrades, taking them away. The Winchester still in his hand, Beard stalked across the floor and confronted Nathan.
Damn it! If you had to shoot somebody, why didn't you shoot the fool who shot Emma?
Because Benton was about to shoot an unarmed soldier in the back. You've just shot two men who had done nothing. I'd say you're in deep enough already.
I'll be the judge of that. Now you and Kinzer tow Benton out back. This is bad for business.
Nathan and Kinzer carried Benton out the back door and put him down.
He's bought himself a mess of trouble. Hurt a soldier and the rest of them will come down on you like a pack of lobo wolves.
Kinzer spoke the truth. Wound or kill a soldier, whatever the reason, and his comrades were likely to show up with fire in their eyes and guns in their hands. It was but a matter of time, and for Edward Beard, that time arrived quickly. The night after Beard had shot the two soldiers, it was ominously quiet, with nobody at the poker tables. Two or three men were upstairs, but none of the soldiers had returned.
Them soldiers will be back, and there'll be hell to pay.
Just shut up!
Oh, they'll come back and kill us all!
Everybody out of the saloon, and nobody gets hurt. We're fixing to burn the place to the ground.
Like hell. Stone, Kendrick, shoot, damn it!
There's nobody to shoot at, you damn fool. They're out of pistol range and it's dark out there, while we're lit up like a Christmas tree. You played out your string. Don't make it any worse.
Beard continued firing into the night, and while he had no targets, the soldiers did. The hanging lamps began exploding, shattering flaming coal oil everywhere. One of the lamps showered Beard with burning oil. Girls practically fell down the stairs in various stages of dress and undress, while men fought their way down, boots in their hands. Soon, flames were racing up the outside walls and licking in through the shattered windows. Smoke swept down the stairs as the second floor caught.
You men outside, hold your fire! We're coming out!
Come on! We won't shoot!
Thank God! When we go out, we'll go out shooting!
I reckon not.
Kinzer made short work of Beard's fighting ambitions by knocking him senseless.
Take the crazy varmint's feet and we'll tote him out.
100 yards from the burning saloon, they left Beard under an oak. Shower of sparks, the saloon's roof caved in. As the vengeful soldiers rode out, Kinzer looked down at Beard's unconscious form.
I don't aim to be here when he comes to.
Neither do I.
Adios.
Yeah!
Dodge City, Kansas, June 8th, 1873. Dodge was a risky place for Nathan, thanks to the reward offer in the Kansas City Liberty Tribune. But Nathan was friends with the commander at Fort Dodge and knew he could get the latest news from the fort's telegraph. He was given permission to speak to the post telegrapher.
Do you read code?
Yes.
I keep copies of all incoming messages for 30 days, but they're just like I took them off the wire. No military secrets, nothing classified.
Well, that wouldn't concern me. I have friends on the frontier, and all I want is to see if they're alive and staying out of trouble.
Nothing there but routine stuff. If you have contacts at other posts, I could inquire.
I know Captain Ferguson at Fort Worth. Since you're not busy, tell him Nathan Stone wants to know what's happening in Texas, aside from the Comanches raising hell.
Corporal Henniger sent the message. When the reply came, Henniger knew it was bad news, but he didn't know how bad until he saw Nathan's face blanch a deathly white.
Is this fella a friend of yours?
Yes. Ranger Captain Sage Jennings is one of the best friends I have in this world. Nothing could be worse than knowing he's been backshot lying there in Fort Worth and may never walk again.
Well, I'm sorry to have brought you this kind of news.
Don't be. I'm obliged to you. Otherwise, I might have been months getting back to Texas. Now I can ride out today.
All he had was the barest of details, that Jennings had been ambushed and that he was badly wounded, but that was enough to send Nathan to Fort Worth. Jennings would be in no condition to go after his bushwhackers, but that wouldn't stop Nathan Stone. Riding steady, resting his horses hourly, he could reach Fort Worth, 380 miles distant, within 6 days. He only hoped Jennings would live until he could talk to him and learn who had done the shooting. Fort Worth, Texas, June 16th, 1873.
Captain Jennings has been here 2 weeks. He was brought here because we have a post surgeon. He was hit 4 times, and 2 of the slugs were lodged near the spine. Our medic, Lieutenant Carter, successfully removed the lead.
But he still can't move?
No.
I'm obliged for what you've done, Captain. I'd like to talk to him, if I may.
You'll find him at the post hospital.
Nathan could scarcely believe his eyes. Jennings lay silent, his eyes closed. His body seemed to have shrunk, graying his hair, transforming him into an old man.
Cap? Captain Jennings?
Nathan. Nathan Stone. I'd take your hand if I could. But that's just one of the many things I can no longer do.
The lump in Nathan's throat felt half the size of Texas as he moved a chair near the old ranger's bed. Swallowing hard, he sat down and waited until he finally trusted himself to speak.
Who did it, Cap?
I can't truthfully say. But I was trailing the Horrells and Clint Barkley. I rode into that ambush like a damn tenderfoot.
You have every reason to believe it was the Horrells, then.
Yes, but I have no proof. It happened near Georgetown. A rancher heard the shots and found me. The doc here dug out the lead, but I'm hurt in two places near the spine. He says my chances are 50-50. I may heal in time. And then I may be crippled for life. Just like them skunk-striped Horrells. Leaving just enough life in me so I ain't worth a damn to nobody.
You haven't had time to heal, Cap. Did anybody trail the varmints?
No. They still got no sheriff of Georgetown. And by the time the sheriff from Lampasas rode over there, the trail had been rained out. Later, when I finally could talk a little, Captain Ferguson telegraphed the ranger outpost in Austin. I asked for a man to be sent to the Horrell ranches, and they're deserted. They've quit the territory, taking Clint Barkley with them, I reckon.
They gunned down three lawmen at Lampasas, and now you. What does it take for the state of Texas to put a bounty on their heads?
I'm through wondering what the state of Texas will or won't do. I've been officially reprimanded by the governor for trailing the Horrells without authorization from the state. And after a review, my commission with the Rangers may be revoked. I might as well just die, damn it. And just get out of everybody's way.
Listen, you old catamount, you're not about to die. At least not for a few more years. You're going to get up out of that bed, and when you do, you'll still be wearing the star of the Texas Rangers. Now, I have things to do, and I'll see you again tomorrow.
The old ranger managed a grin. Nathan composed a telegram to Washington to his friend Byron Silver at the office of the Attorney General. While Captain Sage Jennings might never rise from his bed, he wouldn't be stripped of his commission as a Texas Ranger. The following morning, Nathan returned to the post hospital, where he found Captain Jennings in a better frame of mind.
You don't aim to roost here until I'm on my feet.
No, I reckon you can manage that without me. I aim to mosey around and see if I can find out where that bunch of Horrells went.
I suspected as much.
I like to think you'd do the same for me.
I would. It means a lot having you here. A man never knows who his friends are until he's down. I'm obliged.
You'll be hearing from Byron Silver.
You telegraphed him?
I did. If I hadn't, he'd have skinned me like a coyote and hung my hide out to dry.
He went to Washington to work among the Yankees, but he's never stopped being a Texan.
I'll be in touch with Captain Ferguson by telegraph. And when I ride back this way, I want to see you on your feet. Maybe I'll spend Christmas with you.
I'd like that. Ride careful, amigo.
Before riding out, Nathan took the time to meet with Captain Ferguson.
When you have access to the telegraph, get in touch with me and I'll see that you get a progress report on Captain Jennings.
I'm obliged.
Nathan saddled his horse, loaded his pack horse, and rode out, with Cotton Blossom following. Georgetown, Texas, June 22, 1873. Nathan began questioning people about the Horrells and where they might have gone after quitting the territory. He learned nothing of importance until he reached Duncan's Mercantile. There he spoke to Andrew Duncan, who seemed reluctant to talk.
I can't tell you nothing.
Damn it, I'm looking for Clint Barkley and the Horrells, nobody else. From what I've learned, they've quit the territory. Now, I know the Horrells hired riders from around here, and I want the names of some of those men.
No, I ain't wanting to be on the bad side of them. I got to live here.
I won't name you unless I'm forced to bring the law into this. Now, speak up.
Tobe Warner, Watt Iverson, and Bob McKeever. And I ain't seen any of them in a month.
It was more than Nathan had expected. There was always a chance the trio had ridden away with the Horrells, but an equally good chance they had not. For 3 days, Nathan rode from one ranch to another. Eventually, at a Circle J line camp, he found a surly, uncooperative Bob McKeever.
I told you I quit the Horrells. I don't know where they went, and I don't give a damn.
When Nathan took a step toward McKeever, the rider went for his gun. His left hand moving like a striking rattler, Nathan seized McKeever's arm, forcing him to drop the Colt. Releasing McKeever's right wrist, Nathan let the man slump to the ground. McKeever sat there, looking for his dropped Colt. But Nathan had retrieved the weapon, and swung out the cylinder, and was punching out the shells.
Damn you, you got no right to—
I reckon you still need some convincing. Get up.
I got no reason to fight you. I ain't done nothing.
You know more than you're telling. Thanks to those damn no-account Harrell's, a mighty good friend of mine may not make it. By God, somebody's gonna pay.
But I didn't shoot nobody.
I didn't say he'd been shot, but you knew, damn you, and you know who did it. Now you tell me what you know. Every damn thing you know, or I'll beat your ears down around your boot tops.
It was Clint Barkley shot the Ranger. That's when I quit.
I believe you. Now where did Barkley and the Harrells go?
The Harrells was going to New Mexico territory. Barkley had a woman in Ellsworth or Hayes, said he was going there.
Nathan rode north, Cotton Blossom and the pack horse trailing behind. He spent his nights on the trail, avoiding towns. McKeever had implicated Barkley and the Harrells in the ambush of Captain Jennings, and the lot of them quitting the territory was characteristic of the back-shooting sidewinders they were. Barkley, having done the actual shooting, would want to get as far away as he could. Nathan wanted Barkley. He had to consider the possibility that Barkley had remained with the Harrells, that he might find them all in New Mexico territory. But suppose Clint Barkley had ridden to Kansas? By the time Nathan reached Kansas by way of New Mexico territory, Barkley could lose himself in Colorado, Wyoming, Nebraska, or the Dakota territories.
We'll try Ellsworth and Hayes, Cotton Blossom. If we don't find him there, then we'll look for him and those damn Harrells in New Mexico territory.
The second day after crossing the Red River into Indian territory, Nathan was sure he was being followed. In the territory, death might come from any direction, and sometimes the back trail took priority over what lay ahead. Reaching a rise, Nathan always paused, looking back. The sun bore down with a vengeance, and at first Nathan thought it was distance, that his eyes were seeing the tag end of a dust devil. Topping the next rise, he saw it again. A telltale puff of dust, while not a breath of air stirred.
I don't know who you are, mister, but I don't aim to ride across Indian territory with you on my back trail.
Nathan rode to the bottom of the slope. Yep. He removed his Winchester from the boot. From much experience, Cotton Blossom knew this was gun work and remained with the horses. Nathan crept back up the rise, keeping within cover of underbrush and thickets. When he had a good view of the farthest slope, he bellied down and waited. The rider was bearded, and while Nathan couldn't be sure, he felt like he had seen this man in the cafe in Waco.
That's far enough. You're covered.
You don't own this territory. I got as much right here as you.
Pilgrim, you've been on my back trail since I left Fort Worth, and whatever your reason, I don't reckon it's in my best interests. Using just your thumb and finger, ease out that Colt and drop it, and step down from your saddle.
The response was what Nathan had expected. The stranger kept his horse between them and fired from beneath the belly of the animal, but the slugs ripped the air over Nathan's head. The stranger's spooked horse moved, and Nathan's slug caught the gunman in the chest, slamming him on his back. Nathan rose up and ran, moving to kneel beside the dying man.
Who are you? Why are you trailing me?
I ain't talking.
El Gato. You were with El Gato, one of the two varmints that escaped. You murdered my wife.
We all had her. Every damn one of us.
Nathan was about to smash the man's head with the butt of the Winchester, but it was too late. The outlaw was dead. Unsaddling the man's horse, Nathan set the animal free.
Get along now. Yeah!
He left the dead man where he lay. The buzzards and coyotes were welcome to him. Nathan rode on, his mind drifting back to that terrible night in Indian territory when he had found Mary dead after having been violated by El Gato's outlaws. Nathan had gone after them in a blazing rage, killing 10. He had accounted for the 11th man in Waco, and now he had gunned down the 12th and last in the wilds of Indian territory. But there was no elation, no joy, only the empty realization that gunning them down could in no way compensate for all he had lost. Then, from the forgotten past, drifting over the lonely years, came a Bible verse his mother had taught him.
Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
It makes sense. Kill a man and he's lost to you. It's up to someone higher than me to throw the varmint into the fire. He'll fry forever. And that will mean something.
He kept riding, unsatisfied, but knowing that he had avenged Mary in the only way he knew how. Dodge City, Kansas, July 6, 1873. Arriving in Dodge in the late afternoon, Nathan found himself looking forward to a bath, town grub, and a clean bed. Checking in at the hotel, he bought copies of the St. Louis Globe Democrat and the Kansas City Liberty Tribune. As Nathan left the hotel lobby, the desk clerk studied the register and then looked at the clock. His relief would arrive within the hour. Then he would talk to Sheriff Harrington. Reading the St. Louis paper, Nathan found little of interest. But the Kansas City paper had an item from Wichita. Edward Beard had begun construction on another saloon and dance hall, vowing to have it in operation by October. Another article told of Ben Thompson and his troublesome brother Billy spending the night in jail following a brawl in a Kansas City saloon. The unpredictable pair had left town the next day, traveling west. His shift over, the desk clerk paid a visit to Dodge City's sheriff's office.
Come on in, Harley. Somebody robbed the hotel?
Nathan Stone, the gent with the dog, checked in a while ago.
He's at the hotel now?
No. After taking a room, him and the dog went out. Do you reckon there's a reward?
I don't know. I had a telegram from the Pinkerton office in Kansas City, and all they asked was that I wire them immediately if Nathan Stone showed up. They made a point to say he has a dog with him.
No reward, then. A man wanted by the law ain't likely to be signing his own name on a hotel register.
I wouldn't think so. But it seems likely this is Stone. I'll telegraph the Pinkerton offices. Tell them Stone's here, and we'll see what happens.
Once the Kansas City Pinkerton office received Sheriff Harrington's telegram, they sent a message to a Kansas City hotel. Hate-filled eyes read the message, and steady hands loaded a Colt revolver. Then a lone figure headed to the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad Terminal. The schedule said the next train would depart within the hour, arriving in Dodge before dawn. One passenger moved away from the others as they stepped down from the train, and taking a seat on a bench, waited for the town to awaken. With the first gray light of dawn, Nathan and Cotton Blossom headed for the cafe.
Nathan Stone, I'm Sheriff Harrington. I need to talk to you.
Harrington's Colt was thonged to his right thigh, and he looked all business. But the sheriff wasn't alone. With him was a girl with short dark hair under a flat-crowned hat. Her boots were scuffed, her Levi's faded, and her old red flannel shirt seemed too large. She looked maybe 21 or 2, and her eyes were brimming with hatred. Before the sheriff could speak another word, she drew from the folds of her shirt a Colt revolver.
Hey!
He forced the muzzle of the Colt downward, but the girl was resourceful and cat-quick. Facing Harrington, she drove a knee into his groin and wrested the Colt free. But she now had Nathan Stone to contend with. Before she could knock and fire the Colt, he caught her wrist, and when she tried to knee him as she had the sheriff, he seized her ankle. Using that and the hold he had on her wrist, he lifted her off the ground and slammed her down on her back. She let go of the Colt, and Nathan kicked it back toward the hotel. She struggled to her knees.
You could help me.
I could lock you up for attempted murder. And I might yet, you little catamount. You lied to me. You told me you wanted to talk to Stone.
No, I do want to talk to him. To tell him who I am. Then I aim to kill him because he murdered my brother.
You don't have to tell me who you are. You're from Missouri and you're one of the Limbaughs.
Amy by name. You know her?
No, but I know why she's after me. I had to shoot her hot-headed brother or he'd have shot me. There's just a hell of a lot she hasn't told you, Sheriff, and I aim to fill in the gaps. Then I want to know how she dragged you into this.
We'll talk in my office. Starting to draw a crowd.
The three of them walked the short distance to the lawman's office. There were four cells, none of them occupied. Harrington pointed to the first one.
In there, Amy. I aim to hear Stone's side of this, then I'll decide what to do with you.
Nathan told Harrington the story of how he tried to avoid Rusty's challenge and the sad outcome when the youth insisted on a gun duel.
What you've said has a ring of truth, but I aim to telegraph the Attorney General's office in Jefferson City, Missouri. It's as much for your benefit as for my own. And I figure if they hear from enough lawmen, all of us raising hell, the state might get to the bottom of this and clear you.
I'm more interested in getting the Pinkertons off my trail. They're after me so this female sidewinder can fill me full of lead, and she has no legal right. I'm of a mind to ride to Kansas City and pull some Pinkerton fangs.
Yeah, you'd be more than justified. Fact is, after I've telegraphed the Missouri Attorney General's office, I'll contact the Pinkerton office in Kansas City. They should be told what Miss Amy Limbaugh's intentions are, and that as a result of their being involved, you're in a position to bring charges against them. If they persist in hounding you, then I'd suggest you do exactly that. Now, let's ride to Fort Dodge and send those telegrams.
He's a killer, and I'll find him wherever he goes without the Pinkertons.
He could have shot you dead and claimed self-defense. Instead, he disarmed you. That is not the mark of a killer. Now you cool your heels till I get back.
Harrington sent two telegrams, one to the Pinkerton office and one to the Missouri District Attorney. In less than a quarter of an hour, the Pinkertons responded. The telegram was simple and to the point. Sheriff Harrington was to detain Amy Limbaugh until a Pinkerton operative could question her.
I reckon it won't stop her from coming after you, but she likely won't have the help of the Pinkertons. Won't be another train out of Kansas City till tonight, and then they'll give you a head start.
Thanks.
They waited for almost an hour for the Missouri District Attorney's office to respond, and when the telegram came, it satisfied Sheriff Harrington.
You told it straight. The shooting was ruled self-defense, and the state has no charges against you. When that Pinkerton varmint steps down from the train, I'll shove this in his face.
Before I ride out, I have some advice for Miss Amy Limbaugh.
Well, Amy, Stone told me the truth, and the Pinkertons have asked me to keep you here until they can talk to you. If you know how, I'd reckon you better come up with some truth of your own.
Damn you! You can't hold me without charges! What are the charges?
I don't know all the fine points of the law, but we can always use attempted murder. The Pinkertons may have some of their own. Without their knowledge, you use them with the intention of committing a crime. Legally, Stone can sue the socks off them, and they know it. For that matter, when the Pinkertons are finished with you, Stone can file charges of his own. I certainly wouldn't blame him.
No charges. When the Pinkertons have had their say, turn her loose.
Damn you, I don't want any favors from your kind.
You've had your first and last favor from me. Next time you pull a gun on me, I'll kill you.
Kansas City, Missouri, July 12, 1873. While Nathan expected Sheriff Harrington to truthfully present his case to the Pinkertons, he still intended to confront them personally at their headquarters. As he stepped into the lobby of the Pinkerton Detective Agency, Amy Limbaugh and a pair of hired guns observed him from their hiding place across the street.
Find some cover and spread out. When he leaves the building, wait until he's down the steps and away from it, then cut him down.
Nathan was shown into the office of Roscoe Edelman, a regional director of the Pinkerton Detective Agency.
There's a gun-toting female named Amy Limbaugh who aims to kill me. Through Sheriff Harrington and Dodge, I've learned the Pinkertons are responsible for her being on my trail. Now, I'm here to tell you the straight of it, that the Limbaughs have no legal case against me, and I can prove it. If just one more sheriff comes after me as a result of your damn telegrams, I am to purely raise hell right here on your doorstep. Do you understand?
I am not accustomed to being threatened, and I refuse to be intimidated by a mouthy gunman. We have acknowledged our mistake, and we will no longer concern ourselves with your whereabouts. That's all the consideration you're going to get from this office. Close the door on your way out.
Fighting his temper, Nathan turned and walked out. He left the building and was at the foot of the front steps. Lead slammed into his left side above his pistol belt, throwing him back against the steps. There was no way he could make it back to the safety of the building. He rolled off the steps, drawing his right hand Colt. Belly down, he had become a more difficult target, and just for a moment, his antagonist forgot his cover. Nathan shot him twice. A second man fired. Nathan fired once more and had the satisfaction of seeing the killer stumble and fall. The slug tore into Nathan's left thigh as he realized he was caught in a three-way crossfire. The third bushwhacker was to Nathan's left and much nearer. An easier target. Nathan's slug had struck Amy under the collarbone. All three of the bushwhackers were down, and Nathan sat up when the sheriff and his deputy arrived.
I'm Sheriff Wilhelm. Drop the gun. The party's over.
I didn't open the ball, Sheriff. Three bushwhackers cut down on me, and they've all been hit.
You're just hell on little red wheels with a pistol, ain't you? Carl, see to them that's hurt.
You that's been hit. Hold your fire. I'm a sheriff's deputy. He's right, Sheriff. There's three of them, and one's dead. The other two are wounded, but they'll live. One of them's a female.
A crowd had gathered, drawn by the gunfire. One man, a press card under his hat band, approached the sheriff.
Sheriff, I'm Brandon Wilkes with the Liberty Tribune.
I know who you are, and I ain't got no time to talk to you.
Well, I'm not here to talk to you. I want a story from this gentleman who seems to have survived all the shooting. Mr. Stone.
Nathan Stone.
Get on over there, you two.
Carl herded a bearded man and a bleeding, weeping Amy Limbaugh toward Sheriff Wilhelm. Nathan suspected the girl was playing on the sheriff's sympathy, and to his disgust, Wilhelm seemed to be responding.
Ma'am, the doctor's office ain't far. Can you make it, or do you need help?
Sheriff, this is the second time this little hellion has tried to kill me. By God, if you don't take that Colt away from her, I'm going to.
I tried, but she wouldn't give it to me.
Ma'am, you'll have to give me the gun.
Are you the Nathan Stone who once was a troubleshooter for the Kansas Pacific? The man who rode into Indian Territory and single-handedly gunned down a band of train robbers?
I am. I'd be obliged if you'd point me toward the doctor's office. The sheriff has his hands full.
Damn it, Wilkes, you're interfering. All these people are in my custody, and I'll see that they're given medical attention. Now get the hell out of here.
Not so fast, Sheriff. I want my position in this brought out into the open, and I don't like the way you're going at it. That female rattler you've cozied up to is responsible for this ambush, and I aim to see that she's charged with attempted murder. She has no legal grounds for coming after me, and I can prove that with one telegram. I believe Mr. Wilkes here might be willing to send that telegram in return for hearing how this all started.
Damn right I will. Right after the doctor seen to your wounds.
Sheriff, I want it understood before witnesses that I will be pressing charges against this woman and her hired killers. I can present enough state-sanctioned evidence to hang them both.
Like hell! This woman, she paid me and Turk $500 apiece. She wanted this gent dead. It was all her idea. Me and Turk, we just done what we was told.
Well, Sheriff, there's your witness for the prosecution. I expect he'll sing like a mockingbird to save his own neck. Once I've heard Mr. Stone's story and sent his telegram, the three of us will get together and satisfy your curiosity as to how all this began and the reasons behind it.
Clearly, Sheriff Wilhelm didn't like it, but there had been too many witnesses to the hired gunman's hasty confession. After Nathan had been patched up by the Kansas City doctor, he encountered Brandon Wilkes again at the telegraph office.
For a man that's been shot twice, you manage remarkably well. You can always do your talking when you're feeling up to it.
I don't aim to do another damn thing until this is settled.
Then you were serious about sending that telegram?
Yes. It's to be sent to the office of the Attorney General, Jefferson City, Missouri. Ask for a report on the Limbaugh shooting in Springfield, May 18th, 1872. I was forced to shoot in self-defense and no charges were filed.
After the telegram had been sent, Nathan and Wilkes waited for a reply.
Way I see it, your newspaper owes me. I came out of Indian Territory, shot all to hell, and by the time I was on my feet, your riders had painted me a yard wide and 9 feet tall. Every damn wet behind the ears kid with a Colt and shells wanted to test my draw. But it didn't end there. Taking the word of the Limbaughs, your newspaper set me up as a killer on the run with a price on my head.
Yes, I remember. We even used the etching from your days with the Kansas Pacific. But now it's time to put things right. Just as the Liberty Tribune falsely accused you, it can now exonerate you by printing your story from start to finish. It can also turn public sentiment in your favor and against the Limbaughs.
I'm counting on that, but it'll be a mixed blessing. While I'll be rid of the Limbaughs, I'll look for a whole new crop of young fools to challenge me, trying to make themselves a name at my expense.
Sir?
Looks like you've got your reply.
Nathan took the paper from the clerk and read it with satisfaction. He showed it to Wilkes.
It's just as you said. Now, if you're up to it, I think we're ready to talk to Sheriff Wilhelm.
Wilhelm had his prisoners in cells, and Amy Limbaugh glared at Nathan through the bars. Wilkes handed the telegram to the sheriff.
It appears you're justified in filing charges. The state will prosecute, but you'll have to be present for the trial.
When?
That depends on what's ahead of you on the docket. Probably 3 or 4 weeks.
Oh, you'll need a place to stay.
I have a place. Eppie Bolivar's. I boarded there while I was with the Kansas Pacific. I have a saddle horse, a pack horse, and a dog waiting for me at the livery nearest the Pinkerton building.
You'd better stay out of the saddle for a few days. I'll fetch a buckboard and drive you to the Bolivar place. We can tie your horses on behind.
Nathan enjoyed the quiet days at Eppie Bolivar's boarding house, and he became more and more impressed with the thoroughness with which Brandon Wilkes wrote the story of Amy Limbaugh's vendetta to avenge the death of her brother. Wilkes asked for and got an in-depth report of the attempt on Nathan's life in Dodge City. In each edition of the Liberty Tribune, Wilkes unfolded a little more of the deadly drama, portraying Nathan Stone as a man wrongly persecuted by a vengeful woman, aided by the powerful Pinkerton Detective Agency. To Nathan's surprise, men who had known him during his days with the Kansas Pacific rallied around him. One of them was Joel Netherton.
The railroad can still use you. Outlaws are still robbing trains, but with you riding shotgun, your reputation alone would scare them away.
Thanks, Joel, but it's my reputation I'm trying to live down.
Kansas City, Missouri, August 3rd, 1873. Nathan's wounds healed, and by the day of the trial, he was ready to be done with the whole affair. He listened with disgust as a court-appointed defense attorney tried to convince a jury that Amy Limbaugh was a noble, courageous woman who had sought only to avenge her dead brother. But the jury deliberated only 25 minutes.
As the jury reached a verdict,
"We have, Your Honor. We find the defendants guilty as charged.
The defendants will come forward for sentencing."
Amy Limbaugh and the surviving gunman, Simp Anderton, were led before the bench.
Amy Limbaugh and Simpson Anderton, I hereby sentence each of you to 5 years in the state penitentiary. Court is adjourned.
Damn you all! I'll see you rot in hell. Stone should be the one in prison, not me. He killed my brother!
By God, the woman has greater talent than her ability to fire a pistol. Nonetheless, Mr. Stone, in the interest of your continued good health, I'd suggest you be elsewhere when the state turns her loose.
I aim to be. I have business in Ellsworth.
Nathan returned to the telegraph office and sent a telegram to Captain Ferguson inquiring about Jennings. Ferguson's reply was brief, and Nathan read it a second time, swallowing a lump in his throat.
Regret to inform you, Captain Sage Jennings died 2 weeks ago.
I swear before God, Cap, I'll gun down Clint Barkley if I have to follow him to the gates of hell and go in after him.
Ellsworth, Kansas, August 14th, 1873. Nathan took a room at a boarding house and set out to make the rounds of the saloons. He could think of no more likely place to begin his search for Clint Barkley. At Joe Brennan's saloon, Nathan found Ben Thompson running a game of Monte. Nathan could see that Ben wasn't armed. Thompson flashed him that twisted grin he reserved for his few friends.
Tell you what I'm gonna do. I can hold on to your money. You can come back and try again tomorrow. How's that sound to you, son?
It's nice to see you for once when you're not being shot at, Ben.
This is one of the few towns where I'm on good terms with the law. Sheriff Whitney's a friend of mine, and there's not much shooting because Whitney has a gun ordinance. He'll be asking for your irons.
Oh, he can ask till hell freezes. My guns go where I go. Ben, I'm looking for a killer named Clint Barkley. He may also use the name of Bill Bowen.
About all I've seen look to be soldiers and railroad men.
Thanks. I'll keep on looking. Talk to you later.
As Nathan left the saloon, he passed Ben's brother Billy. The younger Thompson either didn't recognize Nathan or didn't consider him worthy of recognition. But as Nathan stepped outside, he encountered someone who did want to speak to him.
I'm C.B. Whitney, Sheriff of Ellsworth. Are you aware there's a gun ordinance?
I am. I'm Nathan Stone. Are you aware there may be men in this town who would like nothing better than to catch me unarmed?
I'm considering that. I've been reading about you in the newspapers. I'm not one to meddle in a man's business, but under the circumstances, I need to know how long you aim to be here.
Probably not more than another day. I'm looking for a killer. His name is Clint Barkley, and he sometimes calls himself Bill Bowen. He backshot a friend of mine in Texas. He dresses like a cowboy and might hire on with some ranch. He's an aggressive, short-tempered little varmint, reminding you of an overgrown banty rooster.
I know the type, and I reckon him and me would have had words if he'd been through here. Keep your irons. I'm trusting you not to use them unless it's shoot or be shot.
It was a fair offer, and the old sheriff was leaving himself open for criticism by making an exception to the town ordinance. Ellsworth was looking less and less like the kind of place Clint Barkley would hole up. After breakfast the next day, Nathan stopped at the Mercantile and bought 3 newspapers. One of them was a weekly from Dodge City that had news from Texas, and although it was weeks old, Nathan read it with interest. John Wesley Hardin had been involved in shootings in July, once in Cuero, Texas, and again in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Nathan looked for some mention of the Harrells, but found nothing. He did find a death notice for Captain Sage Jennings. The Ranger had been buried at Fort Worth with military honors. There was no mention of any survivors. How many frontiersmen had died thus, alone? Not even a next of kin to mourn his passing. Would that not be Nathan's fate, too? His life's blood leaking into the sand of a lonely arroyo or into the dusty street of some lawless western town. Making the rounds of the saloons, Nathan saved Brennan's until last. He wanted to speak to Ben Thompson before riding out. As he approached the place, Thompson emerged in a big hurry, looking pretty grim. Nathan walked with him.
I got some business with a gambler named John Sterling. I lined up some side bets with him, which we was going to split, but the bastard won a hatful of cash and sneaked out without divvying.
In a nearby saloon, Thompson found Sterling drinking with Happy Jack Morco, a local policeman.
You damn tin-horn thief, you owe me money.
I owe you nothing.
Ben ducked the punch and swung his own fist at Sterling. That was when Happy Jack Morco bought in, drawing his Colt and holding it on Ben.
Well, that's enough, Thompson.
It looked like an even scrap to me.
And who the hell are you?
An hombre that don't like seeing an unarmed man prodded with a gun. Put it away.
I'm the law.
I don't care a damn who you are. You don't need the gun. Ben's leaving. Aren't you, Ben?
Yeah.
Well, you're in violation of the town's gun ordinance.
I have an understanding with the sheriff.
Put your gun away and back off. Get moving, Ben.
Not until they were outside on the boardwalk did Nathan relax.
Damn that Morco! That was between me and Sterling.
You were about to play right into Morco's hands. He wanted you to go after him. Then he could have jailed you for assaulting a lawman or shot you dead.
Nathan thought it was over. By the time he and Thompson returned to Joe Brennan's saloon, Morco and Sterling burst in right behind him.
Get your guns, you damn Texas sons of bitches, and fight!
Before Sterling finished what he had to say, Ben Thompson was out a back door and on the run. Nathan remained where he was. He had no intention of being sucked into a gunfight with a lawman, even if the badge toter was biased and unfair. Ben returned with a rifle and with his younger brother Billy, who was armed with a shotgun and roaring drunk.
I'm not gonna let you two snakes get the jump on my brother!
Billy stumbled, and a load of buckshot narrowly missed 2 bystanders.
Now, you damn sons of bitches, if you want to fight us, here we are.
At that very moment, Sheriff C.B. Whitney arrived and tried to calm the situation.
Come on, break it up. I'm buying the drinks.
Look out, Ben!
Ben turned to see Sterling and Morco charging, guns drawn. Ben brought up his rifle. Morco had ducked into a doorway.
Oh,
Whitney! Oh my God, Billy, you killed our best friend! Billy, get the hell out of here! Let's get you to the livery.
After seeing to it that his brother Billy got out of town fast, Ben Thompson surrendered. To the mayor, not to Morco. To Nathan's surprise, Ben Thompson was only charged with firing at Happy Jack Morco. And when Morco failed to show up in court, the charges were dropped.